Shalom, salam, and welcome to Tour Guide Confidential. My name is Dr. Eyal Duchovny, and I am your host on this backstage tour of the travel industry. Today marks exactly 1 year since the world stopped for me. Exactly 1 year ago today, on March 15th, on the Ides of March, I guided my last tour with two tourists from abroad. Though they never said as much, I'm quite certain that they were both arms dealers, and the reason that they had not left like everyone else was because nothing stops for war. I'm certain that we were literally the last couple of people still attempting to do something resembling tourism here in Israel, as everything was closing behind us. In fact, our first trip took us to the Dead Sea, where we went to one of the large resorts, and they were literally the last two people to visit the resort, as they closed the gate behind us. From there, we went to Jerusalem, and I will never forget how eerie and empty all the classic tourist sites were. It was a typically gray and drizzly winter day, and I could not get over the fact that aside from a lone priest at the main entrance, we were the only people visiting the Church of Gethsemane. It felt like a neutron bomb had been dropped and everyone was gone, or a sci-fi movie about the day after everyone had vanished into thin air. As we walked to the old city, I remember seeing a couple in protective gear for the first time, and it felt like we had entered an alternate reality, which, in essence, we did. I have spoken here about the trials and tribulations of the past year, so there's no point in going over them again. I can report that there is still no end in sight with respect to incoming tourism. For now, even Israelis can barely get back to Israel. Though I had tours scheduled for June, and they've all been cancelled, and I am now waiting for my July tours to be wiped off of my calendar. Though it has not happened yet, I'm guessing that I'll get that call in the next few days. Since all of our unemployment benefits run out in June, I definitely feel again that we're staring at the abyss. On the other hand, I am happy to report that Israel has been a world leader in vaccinations. And it definitely feels like we are on the verge of herd immunity here, though there are still more than a few positive cases every day, about 1,000 or so. The percentage of positive cases and the R number are all in free fall. It indicates that the end of the disease, at least in this version of it, is around the corner. In fact, internally, things seem very normal. People are going out to restaurants and cafes, concerts and sports events, with limitations. But things are happening and people are going back to work. Except, of course, for us tour guides. Tour guides such as myself, especially the ones who work with incoming tourism. In this episode, I interview the extraordinary Ori Unterman. She's a 7th generation Jerusalemite who specializes in guiding groups in Jerusalem. Ori discusses the challenges of the past year and her innovative and exciting new virtual tourism project in the Machane Yehuda market, where she takes groups on live tours in real time through the market and also introduces them to people. Some of you may remember that I have already talked to other guests about virtual tourism in the past. As a solution to the current crisis, when people cannot physically meet, I think that it has been a godsend for a great many tour guides, myself included. Already back in April and May last year, I gave several tours of Haifa and Jaffa that were very well received. Nonetheless, I want to keep things real here on this podcast and say that I do have some real issues with virtual tourism, several of which we bring up and discuss during this episode with Ori. My issue has to do with the fact that the apostles of virtual tourism see this as a new branch of tourism that will continue and prosper after the coronavirus crisis has abated. And so they are promoting it as the future of tourism. Again, this is not something that Ori is saying, but there are people here in Israel who are now talking about this as the future of tourism. Currently, several virtual tourism courses are even making the rounds, and people who are perhaps less technologically inclined have signed up. My question, though, is as follows. Can you really call images on a screen a tour? I'm not sure that you can. And to be honest, it is not really any kind of tourism that I am interested in being involved in the long term. As far as I see it, there are several problems here. For starters, on a virtual tour, you and the guide are necessarily disembodied. Remember, we're living beings, we inhabit space, and we possess 5 senses. A tour on a screen can at best engage 2 of those. There simply is no substitute for being in a place physically. At best, a virtual tour is kind of a glorified information session or maybe a placeholder for the real thing. On a real live tour, you are not just immersed, but you can explore a place on your own during free time. On a virtual tour, even one that is done live, you're being shown what the person who is leading the tour wants to show you. This is true of all visual media. It is by its very nature manipulative. It shows you only what is in the frame and does not show you the other things outside of it. The French philosopher Foucault spoke of what he called administering the silences, and I think that virtual tours cannot help but be guilty of that. Let me give you an example. Back in 1985, my mother was a travel agent, and through her work, she signed up for what they call a fam trip or familiarization trip to Poland. I was a teenager, but since it was so inexpensive, she took me along for the ride. This, as you will recall, was in communist times, and the National Tourism Board, called Orbis, did its best to plan out every single minute of our day. Ultimately, they failed. Not only did we manage to have private conversations with Polish people, where we heard about the hardships of their lives, we also saw things along the way that they just couldn't control. This tour has deeply shaped my view of communism ever since, and my understandings would not have been possible if I had not been there in person. I have no doubt that in the North Korean online fam trips, everyone is happy, well-fed, and adores the dear leader. But I believe that even in North Korea, if you could get there physically, you might have an opportunity to steal a little conversation with someone and maybe see some things that don't show up through Zoom. Lastly, the promoters of virtual tourism present this as a way to level the playing field. They note that people who would not otherwise be able to make the trip can, quote-unquote, experience Israel, and that many of them will eventually make it here as a consequence of what they saw and experienced on the virtual tours that they participated in. Others have noted that Zoom facilitates get-togethers, the types of get-togethers that would not have happened otherwise, with speakers from as far away as Alaska and Australia, all of them in on one call. So if this were in real life, it would be much more difficult to arrange logistically and take much longer to do so. To be honest, I agree with many of these points. My problem is that by definition, this is still not a tour or tourism. Again, it is an information session or a placeholder, and frankly, a wonderful marketing tool that I think can give people a taste of a place, but it is in no way a replacement for it. And as for the ability to bring people together online and at the same time, that is certainly true. We've seen that in the last year more than ever. The problem with this is that it does a great job of helping people stay in touch when they are far apart or under the restrictions of a lockdown, but otherwise it is destructive to local communities. You know, when you could actually meet in person, but you don't because you end up talking on Zoom or WhatsApp or whatever, that actually affects the local community, and I think it also polarizes society. I often think about this Mark Twain quote that I've used before on this show, and I'm going to use it again probably, because in many ways it is my guiding light. Mark Twain wrote, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness." Nothing, in my opinion, can replace an actual trip, an actual meal shared between 2 people or a conversation over a cup of coffee. Even with all of the above, I am optimistic that there will be a need for flesh and blood tour guides for many years to come. If Google and widespread internet access did not kill the guiding profession, neither will Zoom. Having a guide on a tour not only is more efficient and ensures that you only need to focus on enjoying your trip, a guide will show you things that are staring you in the face that you would not see otherwise and take you to places not in the guidebooks or even online. Personally, I am banking on the fact that people are already completely zoomed out and yearning for human contact. So I'm designing tours these days that will focus on bringing people together. As someone with a PhD in anthropology, I think that this is deeply important and where I believe that I personally can make a real contribution. So I've been working on building tours where you can sit down and actually meet another person face to face. By that, I mean a person from one of Israel's various cultural groups and different traditions, so that you can commune with, learn about, and get to know them in person. Please stay tuned here at Tour Guide Confidential and at Israel with Eyal for updates on this exciting new project. To me, it represents the type of tourism that I believe in and the type that I want to see, a tourism that is based primarily on P2P, person-to-person contacts, and only then on history, archaeology, attractions, culinary experiences, etc. I'm saying all of this from personal experience with my guests. What I've seen over the years is that the most memorable and impactful experiences are actually those together with other people. It is there that, in my opinion, tourism manifests its true potential. Okay, I just want to reiterate once again that all of the above that I just said is not meant to imply that people should not be doing virtual tours right now, but that I think that we need to be able to talk about what this means for tourism. I also encourage you to listen here to what Ori and her colleagues have to offer. I am sure that anyone who joins her will enjoy and learn a lot. She is deeply rooted in Jerusalem, deeply loves the place, and I think that comes across no matter whether it's in person or online, and so I encourage you to check out her tour. Lastly, if you have any comments about any of the above, please feel free to write them down on the website at tourguideconfidential.com or by email at tourguideconfidential@gmail.com. Please also share this episode and subscribe to it to help us build a community of listeners. All right, let's listen to this episode with the truly extraordinary Ori Unterman. Shalom, salam, and welcome to Tour Guide Confidential. My name is Dr. Eyal Duchovny, and I am your host on this backstage tour of the travel industry. Today, my guest is Ori Unterman, and we are meeting on Zoom because we're in our third national lockdown here in Israel. We had originally planned to meet in Haifa, but unfortunately, we couldn't meet in person. So we decided to do this by Zoom. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Well, welcome. Welcome to the show. And as you know, because you've listened to previous episodes, I always like to start by asking my guests a little bit about their background, about, you know, where they grew up and what they studied and how they ended up in guiding. So I'd really like to hear your backstory and find out how you ended up as a tour guide.
So I was born and raised here in the city of Jerusalem. And since a young age, I was part of the scouts. I went to the scouts since I was 9 years old. And this is where I actually became to be like a guide or a counselor, a leader of our group. And when I graduated from high school, I was looking for, like, you know, kind of an extra year to contribute to my country. And this is how I ended up looking for something that we call Shnat Shirut. So this is like a gap year where you delay your military service in a year and you volunteer for your community. And I found it in a really unique place. I actually traveled all the way to Canada, to Toronto, and I went to volunteer for the Jewish community there. for the year. And when I returned from this year to Israel, I had to join the army, and I joined the education force, which is a really unique thing that we have only in Israel.
Can you tell us a little bit about it? Yeah,
sure. So the Israeli army believes that if you actually have to give time from yourself to the army, you should also receive something back. So if you're, let's say, you didn't graduate from high school properly, you can graduate from high school during your military service. Or if you just moved to Israel and you're not well integrated into the Israeli society, you can take a few courses, for example, or things like that. And also part of the understanding is that if you are defending the country, you should know what you're defending on. And this is how I ended up at a really unique unit called Yechidat Hasbara. So that would be an explanation unit where my base was kind of a hostel. And every week we would receive different units from throughout the army. So that would be like, you know, someone who just joined the army 2 weeks ago, or sometimes officers or people who are doing like miluim. So that would be the reserved forces, officers, Navy, Air Force. Anyone would come, and we'll be giving them 5 days tours where your base would be. And I was lucky enough to be based in Jerusalem. So basically I was giving tours during my military service for 2 years. And when I finished my military service, I remember I thought what to do, and I applied to university, and my parents told me, you know, you already have a job, you should just get the license. And my parents actually were those who signed me up to the tour guide course. Yeah. Yeah. My mother sent in the application.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then basically I got my, you know, my official license at the summer of 2014, which was during, well, we, I mean, we had a military operation back at the time in Gaza.
I remember
during this
well.
Summer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is how I got here. Yeah. So this is how I became a tour guide.
That's actually the same time that I decided to go and study to be a tour guide. But I guess if you finished in 2014, it must have been difficult. It was a couple months there. There was no work.
Yeah. So it's funny because at the beginning, I was struggling very much to work. I mean, like to give tours and getting paid for that. Because in the army, like that, what I was doing, and like, you know, nobody really pays you for that. So I didn't really feel this like lack of income. And actually I took the year from the summer of 14 till the summer of 15. And I was actually working as a waitress. Because even though I had the license, I wasn't really sure that this is what I want to do. So for me, it was like, I didn't really feel this like, you know, lack of work, because that I wasn't really in the field back then.
And did you study at the university at all?
Yeah. So I studied art history at the Hebrew University for 5 years. At the same time, I did the tour guide course. Yeah, I don't recommend anyone to do the tour guide course and study at university at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's something that it would be interesting to talk about. I mean, how was your experience of the tour guide course? I mean, everyone has different experience, but in general, what would you say your experience was like?
I don't really know how to describe it. I'll try.
Okay.
Overall, I think I enjoyed it. I think for me, it was mostly about like, I mean, getting to know the people, because I came after doing that for 2 years. So for me, the tour guide course, in many terms, I felt that it was just like, you know, many boxes that have to be checked without actually going into depth and like, you know, understanding like, you know, the place or the history. So on one hand, I feel that it wasn't deep enough in terms of knowledge, but I also feel that it wasn't deep enough in terms of like how to be an actual tour guide. In terms of like the guiding itself and logistics and like, you know, how to adapt yourself to different people, different situations.
It's interesting because I felt that it was, in some ways, there was too much knowledge. It was just too many places that we don't really get to, you know, like there's a lot of these sites that we would go to that I've never gone to with a tourist. It may also be because I work primarily with incoming tourism and not with Israeli tourists, but it felt like we were going to a lot of places which were, you know, less important.
So I feel that it was like the Hebrew term, we say, tafasta merube lo tafasta. Like, you know, you're trying to do so much and you end up with like almost nothing in your hands. I feel that every place we went had a point, like, you know, to understand like the big puzzle, the big riddle, which is like, you know, Israel and like how to guide in it and, you know, like to make it approachable to like Israelis or even non-Israelis. But I feel that like, if I didn't dig a little deeper myself, I didn't understand why it's part of the big puzzle. And also I think that, I mean, like, so a lot of the tour guides, either they're based on language, right? Or they based on like, you know, the people they work with, but I guide in a different way. I focus on the geographical area. So my joke is like, I don't like to leave the boundaries of Jerusalem.
yeah, and that's definitely something I want to know more about. Like,
yeah, so like, I'm guiding people in Jerusalem, whether they are Israelis, Jewish, non-Jewish, if they're English speaking, German speaking. I mean, like, we'll talk in English because I don't speak German. But what I'm trying to say is like, I'm very geographical based versus other tour guides that are, let's say, audience based. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, you know, like learning about like, you know, Akko and Haifa and Tel Aviv was extremely important. But because I'm so like deeply based in Jerusalem in terms of like the guiding and the knowledge, I felt that it was very flat in all the other places.
So this is something that's interesting for me to understand about you. Why is it that you're so, you know, tied to Jerusalem? Is it something yourself personally, or is it your family? I mean, have they been living there for generations? What is this about Jerusalem that, you know, really captures you?
So my family actually originally arrived to Jerusalem in the 1830s, all the way from like far, far Russia. We're not really sure where from. And we've been living here ever since.
Well, that's almost 200 years.
Yeah, we're about to have like, you know, an anniversary in 10 years. It will be a nice celebration. And for me to walk around Jerusalem, it's not just history. It's actually like, you know, like it's kind of like my story, my family heritage. You know, to be able to walk around and say like, hey, do you see this bank? I have like, you know, papers in my house that says that my great grandfather took his mortgage from this bank and actually paid his debt. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, it's like a more interesting story than like, you know, oh, the bank was founded by this person at this year, da 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 da.
Right. It personalizes it when it's something that has to do with your family's history as well, with your own family story.
Very much. And more than that, I think that like, you know, being Jewish, and being born and raised in Jerusalem, it's like an understanding of being part of this gigantic chain. And it's not just like, you know, the Jewish chain, it's also like part of the family chain at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, and also I think it's important for your guests to learn that there were Jews living in Jerusalem long before there was a state of Israel, you know, and throughout that whole period. So your family, I mean, do you know how many generations you've been there?
So as far... Since I'm aware that I'm the seventh generation.
Have you done this research?
I'm the seventh generation that was born here in the city.
That's amazing.
And also, like, you know, long-term, I just got engaged and I assumed that, like, you know, at some point I want to be a mother. Thank you very much. And I want to be able to raise my children. And I see a lot of my female colleagues are, like, you know, struggling with, like, you know, not being home for, like, a week, 10 days. And I don't want to have that experience. I want to be able to come home every evening and actually spend time with my family.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, since you raised that point, I mean, that's an important point that I think we should talk about is, you know, the differences, first of all, between guides that are male guides and female guides and how this might affect it. And, you know, what I guess you're referring to here is that, you know, by being based in Jerusalem, rather than like going all over the country, like some guides who do jobs for one day or guides that do 10 days and they're away from home. If you do a 1 day stint, then at the end of the day, you know, usually you're back home. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing 10 days, then you know for a fact that you're going to be gone for that period. So it makes a huge difference. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, this difference that you see and how it affects you also as a guide?
So I was actually doing groups for quite, like leading groups for quite a while. During the high seasons, like during the summer, I used to tell my friends and my family, like, yeah, listen, like I'm leading a group now for 10 days, for 2 weeks, like, don't call me. It's as if I'm out of the country. Right. I have like, you know, a group of people that I need to take care of. And it takes, for me, like it took a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And also I'm pretty fortunate. I mean, like a lot of people are like, even if they're coming to Israel, like they might not take a tour guide for like, you know, their entire visit, but they will like, you know, hire a tour guide for a day or for half a day because like, you know, it's Jerusalem, because it's so complicated. It's so holy. You want to make sure that like, you know, you understand it properly. You want to make sure that you're going to the places that are safe and adaptable for you. And I was actually like doing both for quite a while. And, at the beginning of 2020, I decided, you know, I'm just going to do like, you know, Jerusalem day tours only.
Wait, I'm going to do a little aside here then. Since you focused on Jerusalem day tours, can you tell us a little bit about the types of tours that you offer in Jerusalem? What would a typical day with you look like?
So what I should tell you is that I modify it by every client. Like, you know, like I talk to them for half an hour. They tell me who they are, what the background, but like eventually it's pretty much like, you know, coming down to a few things. Mm-hmm. So most people start with like at least half a day at the old city and we'll try to focus on the three monotheistic religions. So that would be like, you know, visiting the Temple Mount and of course the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Western Wall, because I feel that like every person that grew up in the Western culture have heard about those places in some way. And like, this is extremely interesting, like, you know, to get to visit those places on your own. And then the other side, the other.
If I stop you, just stop you for 1 second there, just so that our guests who aren't familiar, you can just say, you know, little two words about the Temple Mount, Western Wall, and the Holy Sepulchre, so they know which sites you're referring to and where they're located. In three words or less.
Two words will be complicated. I'll do my best. Okay, so we're talking about, so we're talking about like the three holiest sites for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and they're all located inside the old city walls. So this is like 1 square kilometer. So within like 7 minutes walking distance, you can get from the holiest place for Christians to the holiest place for Muslims to the holiest place of Jews.
Which is what makes Jerusalem so special.
This is one of the things, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like everything is so close and at the same time, like so far. And I think the craziest thing about it is like, I'm sure you've experienced yourself the same thing as a tour guide. Like, you know, we know that it's 1 square kilometer. So theoretically, mm-hmm. you can walk down like 10 minutes, one side to the other, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But like every time I'm walking into the whole city, it's never less than 2 hours.
Right.
It's just, it feels never ending. So that would be one side of it. So this is like, you know, a little more like hardcore, historical, intense, like a lot of religion issues, like, you know, even bringing up the question, what makes a place holy? And I think in Jerusalem, it's an inevitable question. And then usually the second part of the day is like much more light. It's not that the first part is not fun, but it's much more like experience focused and fun focused. And usually that would be a culinary experience at what we call the shuk. So that would be the Machane Yehuda market, which is kind of like the modern market in Jerusalem. And it's modern because it's only 150 years old. Mm-hmm. And that would be really like, you know, exploring a little bit about the Israeli culture today through a culinary perspective. So like, you know, not talking about the ultra-Orthodox community, but eating a dish that is affiliated by the ultra-Orthodox community and actually tasting it and like talking to the people, etc.
And those have become really popular in the last couple years, these kind of culinary tours. When you know, started guiding in 2014, did that exist already? Were there people doing that? Because I know you're pretty much, you know, you're a well-known face in the market. You're kind of a celebrity in the market. And you do these tours all the time.
Yeah. A lot of people like, oh, everybody know you. I'm like, yeah, like I work here. I live here. Like
that's your office, that's my hood. Basically. Yeah,
exactly. At the end of the day.
Right.
So 2014, there were few companies that were doing that, but not as much. I believe that like around 2018, it was like the biggest thing to do wherever you're traveling. And I have to say that like a lot of those tours, I work with agencies. So the two major ones is More, and the second one is Yalla Basta. And okay. Both of them are incredible at doing it. And honestly, like, you know, on one hand, of course, you need to have the tour guide, but also you have, like, you know, you got to have the logistics at the front and also behind the scenes. And it's a beautiful combination.
So how do these companies work exactly? I was always kind of wondering about that. Do they go to each one and then they set a price with them beforehand? How you get a voucher? How does this work in practice? Whatever you can tell us, at least.
Of course. So basically, the client is talking to the company, to the agency. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, the client will say, okay, like this is who we are. This is where we're coming from. That's the time frame that we have. That's our budget, pretty much. What can you offer? And then the agency will modify the tour to the group if we have any food restrictions. So like, you know, kosher issues, allergies, time, budget, of course, etc. And of course that the agency, like, you know, it's a hard work to taste everything on the market.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to do that?
So, of course, I mean, I can't really talk about food without tasting it.
Right.
Diet-wise, it's complicated. So I don't eat while I'm giving the tours. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, you know, I'm making sure that wherever I'm going to the group, I think that it's a good place. In terms of like, you know, the flavor, the quality, also the price. I don't pay like, you know, in front of the clients. I give like a voucher. So that would be like a small check. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the month, the agency is paying to all the places at once. So that also spares a lot of times in terms of like, you know, the traveling people are coming on the tour, that we don't have to deal with money on the spot.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So also, everything is extremely fresh. So like if there's something that wasn't made during the day, we might modify the menu as we go. Mm-hmm. And there are things that have to be very fresh. So like I will call the place, you know, 10 minutes before we arrive. And as we'll mm-hmm. get there, you know, the dish will come out of the oven just for us.
Right. And can you give our listeners some ideas of the types of food? Because I don't think people might realize, you know, because, you know, I'm surprised. For me, it just seems so natural that Israel is such a multicultural space. But a lot of people, when they come here for the first time, they're really shocked at how multicultural this place is. So what are the kinds of foods that you could find in the market that when you do a tour that you share with your guests?
So for example, I think the most classic route is to start with a grape leaf stuffed with rice. So that would be something that is like either Greek or even a Kurdish dish. You can find those like this dish in two different places.
They call it dolma, I think, in Greek.
Exactly. And then in Kurdistan, they call it yaprach, but it's exactly yaprach. The same thing. Okay. Yeah. And then like, you know, 5 minutes up the street, you can find khachapuri, which is a dish coming from Georgia, Russia. So that would be right. like melted, very salty cheese inside this magnificent yeast dough. Mm-hmm. Walking up the street, you can find like, you know, the incredible juices of Uzieli, which is actually a Yemenite family that brought a lot of like mm-hmm. Yemenite traditions, everything have to do with herbal medicine. Mm-hmm. And then you can walk down the street and you'll have malawach. So that would be again, like another Yemenite dish that it's almost like a phyllo dough, look like pita bread with a lot mm-hmm. of butter. But then the topping is like hummus and tahini and tomato sauce and deep fried eggplant and za'atar and a hard boiled egg. So the looks of it is like pizza, but the flavors are very like Mediterranean in its own kind of like a kind of a party of flavors and textures in your mouth. And like mm-hmm. three steps up the street, you have an Ethiopian spice store when you can find mm-hmm. like the original Ethiopian flavor spices that we use in the Ethiopian kitchen. And then down the street, mm-hmm. another spice store belong to a Persian family, a Jewish Persian family.
Yeah. And that's important to point out, I think, that all of the things that you mentioned up to now, we're talking about Jewish immigrants from these places who brought with them their cuisines. So whether it's from Georgia or from Persia, all these places, there were Jewish communities in these places. And the market, in a sense, is kind of a, I don't know what to call it, like not really a melting pot, but like, you know, maybe like a tali place.
I call it a culinary reflection. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like a culinary reflection of like, you know, the micro communities that formate what we call the Israeli society for today. Mm-hmm. And I think that especially in Jerusalem, the multicultural is very existing because every community is kind of like setting their own boundaries and they want to be present. And at the same time, like they are very much existing next to the other communities and not as much as like integrating and melting into each
right.
other.
That's a great
and, you know,
point,
you mentioned
yeah.
that all of these are like, exactly. And like, you know, you mentioned that all of those are the Jewish communities because we have another main market mm-hmm. in Jerusalem, which is the original main market, which is the one in the mm-hmm. old city. And this, and like, you know, first of all, like we also have culinary experience in the old city, which is incredible and fabulous and unique. And I highly recommend you to go and do it.
Do tours?
Absolutely. Yeah. Culinary tours also in the old city, which is a very different experience mm-hmm. because again, like it's not only Jewish. So you have another layer of complexity mm-hmm. to talk about. And like this division between the Jewish market and the non-Jewish market is a result of the British mandate.
Really?
When the British basically, yeah, they said like, you know, the best way to take over the community is divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. They said, okay, like in the Machan Yehuda market, we'll have all the ownership, Jewish ownership. Mm-hmm. And then the one in the old city will be just for the Christian and Muslims.
I see. What other differences are there between the markets in terms of, I mean, what do you feel are the differences between these two markets other than the ownership? Are there any?
There are so many. I mean, like they're very different at the same time. They're very mm-hmm. similar. I think that like you can't really take politics out of it. Mm-hmm. Walking like, you know, as an Israeli Jewish person, in the market in the old city, you feel different. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you feel as a minority. And I think that Israeli Jews don't really know how that thing feels. Also in terms of the timing, mm-hmm. you know, like I feel like the market in the old city is much more traditional in terms of the time that it's mm-hmm. open. When the sun goes down, everyone are going mm-hmm. home. Well, at the Machan Yehuda market, we have the entire nightlife scene, which was thriving up until, you know, the right. pandemic broke. I just saw a video, that I took 2 years ago on, New Year's Eve, which was insane.
Wow. Well, I did notice though over the past few years that I think maybe I'm wrong, but you correct me if I'm wrong. I did notice that there are more Arab arriving in Machane Yehuda market and doing their shopping there than I recall in the past. Do you think that's happening, or maybe I'm wrong about that? You know, it just seems like an impression that I saw more Arab shoppers in the Machane Yehuda market, which is the, you know, quote unquote Jewish market, than in the past. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. You know, I didn't notice that. It's really interesting that you're bringing it up. I think that generally speaking, the Jerusalemite society, let's say like for the past 20 years or so, is starting to get divided again by social economical status. So like by, like, you know, regular division by like different cities, right? Like, you know, walking around like Tel Aviv or New York, right? You have like the better neighborhood, the not so great neighborhoods. And what makes the difference is not the religion, is the social economical status. And I think that in the past 20 years, we're starting to see like, you know, an Arabic speaking elite living in Jerusalem, integrated into Western Jerusalem. And since the shuk, the market, became, you know, like a place to see and be seen, those layers of society also want to see and be seen.
Yeah, I think Mati Friedman wrote an article kind of alluding to that, that saying since the Second Intifada and the building of the separation barrier, that there are more Arabs who have the financial means have been living more in Jerusalem, and that as a result, you see them much more in West Jerusalem, you know, again, in quotes, kind of society. So maybe that's what, you know, the process that's going on here.
I think so. I think so very much. And also, I think that like the shuk used to be the Machane Yehuda market. I call it the shuk because this is how we call it here.
Right. Well, we could call it the shuk and the suk, maybe.
Right. Exactly. I feel that it's also affiliated very much like, you know, with the right wing in terms of the political map.
Interesting.
In Israel, I heard about someone that wrote their thesis about how a lot of the different stores in the shuk have the picture of Menachem Begin, which used to be the first leader on the from the Israeli right wing to gain into power, to become the
head of the Likud or Herut, I guess it was at that time. Yeah,
exactly. And I feel that especially since the nightlife scene kicked in, so let's say like in the past 5 to 7 years, the entire area.
Yeah, tell us a little about that because our guests wouldn't know about the nightlife scene. What does that mean?
So it means that up until like even 10 years, you will come to the shuk at night and that would be looking like abandoned. I mean, everything's closed. No one is walking around, just the street cats. But for the past...
Shuttered.
Exactly. But if you would come to the shuk 3 years ago every night, you would see that the businesses are open and everything is like, no bars and restaurants. The music is blasting. All the youngsters are coming to this area. And I think that with this process of the shuk becoming more chic, and the place becoming...
I like that.
Thank you. I think that also the vendors realize that it's also like, you know, financially worth it to be a little more open-minded. So all of a sudden, this area became more gay-friendly. And I think that also the acceptance of the modern, let's say, wealthier Arabic shoppers to the shuk has to be part of this.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's really a reflection of our society and a microcosm of it in many ways, you know, the shuk.
Very much.
Now, I want to ask, you were talking about, you know, pictures of Menachem Begin. One of the things that our listeners wouldn't know unless they have ever been to the shuk, and even then you have to arrive at certain times to see it, is that when all the shutters are closed, most of the different shops in the shuk have murals painted on the shutters. It's been kind of an amazing project that, can you tell us a little bit about that? And what kind of people are on these murals?
Of course. So about like 6 years ago, we had this guy who came all the way from the UK to study at a yeshiva. You know, we have this phenomenon called Yeshiva Boys. Yeshiva is a Jewish study place. And we have a lot of those, like, you know, foreigner.
It's a religious seminary.
Exactly. And a lot of those people like, yeah, like I want to get closer to God, when they actually just like want to get away from their mothers and, you know, like spend the year abroad. So this guy came here from the UK and he said like, you know, I don't get it. Like Shabbat, Saturday is the day where you're supposed like, you know, not, to relax and hang out with your friends and like, you know, to really chill. And he said, but this is exactly what I'm doing in the shuk every night. Like I'm going out and meeting new people. And he said, but Shabbat is the only day that the shuk is completely shut and no one's coming. So at the beginning, it was very much like illegal underground. He just started to like paint graffiti images on the shutters. And it's
spray painted it.
Exactly,
right?
Like classic graffiti. And people were sure, like, no, this is vandalism, what he's doing. But then they realized that, like, you know, he painted the image of the Messiah arriving to Jerusalem on the white donkey. The image of, like, you know, biblical Jerusalem with the water source, Hezekiah Tunnel, that, like, you know, visitors can come and visit up until today. And people really like the concept that, like, you know, he's bringing all those, like, you know, biblical stories. And then he kind of, like, revealed his identity, and his name is Salomon Sosa. And it actually became a cooperation between him and the different shop owners. So we have biblical images next to different leaders from throughout history, both Jewish and general, both men and women. And also the local workers in the shuk, so like the different shop owners and the cleaners. And some of the beggars are even appear on the door. And the concept is, like, you know, if you'll come to the shuk during the day, you will see some of the graffitis on the shutters. Those were open during the night. Right. But if you'll come during the night, you'll see those were just open during the day. So the only day you can see the entire gallery is Saturdays, Shabbat. So the concept is gallery, like Galeria Shel Shabbat, Saturday's gallery. And the original thought was that every Saturday, the religious Jews will come with the booze and the artsy hipsters will come with the food. And together they will party and mingle among the art. And the art will bring them together. Nice. Now, it's actually a beautiful festival that takes place 1 week in the year, right before Purim. And it's a beautiful, I think, like, you know, we always talk about, like, you know, how, especially in Jerusalem, I think it's such a, like, intense city to make any difference in. And a lot of the changes are coming, like, you know, from the bottom and kind of like, you know, only the locals people make a difference in Jerusalem. And I think it's fascinating to see how a foreigner guy, very much not a local, made such a huge impact.
Right. Wow. That's fascinating. And I have to tell you that I lived in Jerusalem for almost 7 years. Okay. Back in the late 80s and early 90s.
Really? Where? In what neighborhood?
I lived in different places. I lived in Musrara for a couple of years. I lived in Beit Vagan. I lived in the dorms. I lived in Givat Zarfatit and French Hill. So I lived in a couple of different places during those years. But I think the city has really changed since then. The city has become much more religious than I remember it in the late 80s. It's much more, as we would say, you know, here it's black, you know, in the sense of like the way people wear the men in their black, you know, clothes. And even then, what was interesting for me was there were, of course, you know, religious neighborhoods. What was interesting is that the non-religious, and this is why I bring this up here, the non-religious were in some ways more non-religious than non-religious in other parts of Israel. It was like this. It was because they were reacting to this kind of religious society that they were very kind of militantly secular. And there was, back then, there was also, you know, LGBTQ scene, and it was quite militant in its way. And there were also very secular Jerusalemites. But I see things changing. What do you think about the changes that are happening in Jerusalem in your lifetime?
So I think part of the beauty of the city is that everybody feels a minority. Regardless, like, you know, your gender, your religion, your social economical status, you always feel that the city belongs to a majority that you're not part of. And it means that you have to be stronger in terms of like your identity and your boundaries. On one hand, like, you know, I do feel how the city is changing and like getting more and more black, as you said. But on the other hand, when we're looking down on it, in terms of numbers, during the past 10 years, we have more and more businesses that are not kosher. They're open in Shabbat and serve. Yeah. So like, you know, I'm struggling to say secular because, like, you know, the word secular in Hebrew, chiloni, is coming from the word sand. And it feels like I feel that it's like, you know, kind of a disrespectful term. So let's call it the modern. I feel like the modern community in Jerusalem, even like, you know, you don't really feel that it's getting bigger. I feel that like the businesses that are opening are the number is going higher. And also the roots are getting deeper, you know, like if, you know, like 20 years ago, I mean, I'm 30 now. So like, you know, the secular girl, the 10 years old, my friends felt disconnected from this place. I can say that, like, you know, I'm 30, I'm secular, and I owe this place as much as the religious people, the community. And also I think that another point of it is not to be afraid to cross to the other part of the city. You know, you mentioned Givat Zarfatit, the French Hill. This is actually the neighborhood that I grew up in. And right now I live in Beit HaKerem.
Okay.
Beit HaKerem is considered to be like, you know, secular, kind of like a respected neighborhood, a really good place. And French Hill is considered to be a little sketchy. It's right on the border with East Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other weekend I was out of milk during Shabbat and I couldn't get any.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my mother and she said, oh, I wish you could live next to us because like, you know, we get in the car, we drive for 3 minutes to Eastern Jerusalem, to the Muslim part, and everything is open on Shabbat.
Right.
And I think that like, once you're not afraid to cross those borders, like, you know, to the other part of the city, regardless what part you're coming from, the city never ends. There are so many different options at any time. You can honestly, on one hand, you can celebrate any holiday on the planet in this city. And at the same time, on the other part of the city, everything will be open because those people don't celebrate this holiday.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. You know, and we come with guests also on Shabbat. You know, we take them to the parts where things are open so that they can, you know, have a lunch, can, you know, can experience the city.
Exactly. And like, I mean, even, you know, Yom Kippur 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
We were walking around, like, you know, we were walking around. Yeah. So like, you know, we were walking around the western part of Jerusalem and the Jewish quarter. And it's like complete silent, like nothing's happening. Then like, you know, we cross to the Christian quarter and everything's normal. Everything's open.
So for our guests who aren't familiar, Yom Kippur is in English known as the Day of Atonement. And it's a day in which Jews spend the entire day typically, first of all, fasting, but also going to synagogue and reflecting on their deeds. And in Israel, really, which is, you know, I actually think tourists should come here. Usually people avoid Israel during Yom Kippur. But if you ever want to see a place that looks like, you know, a neutron bomb went off or something, where there are no cars, no airplanes that day, the airport is closed, the borders are closed, the radio doesn't work on that day, the TV is off. It's literally, you know, I don't think there's any other place in the world where something like that happened.
For 25 hours, everything is shut down. It's incredible.
Yeah. But yet in Jerusalem, you can experience that if that's what you want. But you can also experience what you're saying is, you know, normalcy where shops are open because there are so many communities there.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, like Jerusalem is the city that has been divided throughout history so many times. Like, you know, the recent border that we know is, of course, like, you know, the border that divided the city between Israel and Jordan. Which we refer to today as the Green Line. And today we have the barrier that is dividing Jerusalem from the West Bank. And historically, we had all kind of different borders. And I really feel that walking around Jerusalem today, like, you know, we realize that those borders exist within ourselves. Because physically, nothing blocks me from walking from Western Jerusalem to Eastern Jerusalem. And I think, like, you know, especially, like, you know, someone coming from Western culture, like, you know, learning about, you know, like even the world in Berlin, right? We come with this, like, you know, pictures in our head of like borders and their existing. I think, like, you know, walking around Jerusalem, you learn to redefine those borders. And you also realize that who's defining those borders is just you. And the second you're learning how to cross them in a way that is, like, you know, right for you, you really feel like, you know, no one can stop you. It's the best feeling there is.
Well, there's so many ways we can go with this, but I want to come back to this. I want to go back 1 second to the shuk. It was something that I wanted to ask you earlier, which is, I studied anthropology. One of the topics that is taught in anthropology is the anthropology of food and the way that food is connected to culture. But interestingly, also what's happened over the years in the United States, for example, and I'm sure in Canada as well, and in Europe, is as those societies have become more multicultural, foods from other cultures have entered into American society and European society. And what's happened over the years is that for a lot of people, Westerners, who, you know, may have come from societies that actually went out into the world and colonized and took over these places, those Westerners aren't doing that anymore. But what they're doing is they're taking in now as these immigrants come, and they're eating these foods. And there's this sense almost among Westerners that, like, if you eat the food of another culture, you somehow know that culture. I just kind of wonder if you ever thought about that, how people, they think that, oh, well, you know, people brag about the foods that they've eaten. And, you know, when you were talking about all the different foods in the market, I was kind of wondering if there isn't something a little bit kind of, you know, this kind of orientalizing about doing that, Have you ever thought about that experience, about what it means to like eat the food of another culture? Does that provide you with any authenticity or not? I don't know. I'm throwing this out there just because I was thinking when you were talking about it.
So I'll be honest with you. A lot, like, I think that like when people imagine a culinary tour, they imagine like restaurants hopping. So like you're actually right. Every place, like, you know, they'll host you and like, you know, get the entire experience. When you're like, when you're on a culinary tour, you're eating in the street. Mm-hmm. So even like, you know, even if you're eating a Georgian dish that is originally from Georgia, Russia, you eat it next to like, you know, the person doing their shopping for fruits and vegetables, or to the cleaner, just like, you know, sweeping the street. So like, you know, you have this sense of like, you know, this community is like, you know, left their mark here, but you're part of this huge tapestry called Jerusalem or Israel. And like, you know, we already talked about it, but I feel like because Jerusalem is so complicated and like, you know, everyone is a minority, everyone are like, on one hand, like they're really curious about like, you know, the other, like different cultures and traditions. But on the other time, they're really afraid to like fully integrate into those traditions or cultures because it might like, you know, take away something of their own identity.
Well, that's why, you know, these culinary tours, they kind of offer you this kind of like salad bar of different culinary experiences, which grant you with this kind of like sense. I don't know. I guess I'm not being entirely clear, but maybe some of my listeners are familiar. In the United States, there's a supermarket chain called Trader Joe's. Okay. Trader Joe's is very popular in the US. And it's, what it does is it has all these different ethnic foods from different places in the world in a very kind of modern, shiny, clean kind of store. Now, I know the Shuk is not that, but it's this kind of clean store. And it's become super popular among Americans who go shopping there, because in a sense, like, they're scared to go to like, you know, the local Indian store, because everything is kind of messy, you know, like, you know, they don't know what to ask for. And here it's kind of packaged specially for them. They're scared to go to the Ethiopian store or the Persian store, and yet they want to have this kind of experience to feel authentic. And so I wonder if, you know, this is something that I've also asked other guests, because I feel like on some level, tourism is like a conspiracy of euphemisms. You know, euphemism is like good things that you say. It's like this conspiracy of euphemism, and it's a simulacra. It's like we present people with this kind of simulated version of the world that they can purchase and take as an experience with them. And so I wonder, you know, if this experience in the market, like, are you in some sense selling them authenticity also? I don't know. I threw a lot of ideas out there. I don't know. You know,
I think the question is like, how do you define authenticity? Like, you know, once we're going, let's say, like, you know, to the Georgian restaurant, I'm not telling them, oh, welcome to Georgia, you know, let's have all the Georgian wine on earth, because like that's the great Georgian wine. Right. This is not what we're doing. Like, you know, we talk about the Georgian restaurants in like, you know, the place of what it's like to be an immigrant in the 90s in Israel, in the Shuk, that is like, you know, most of the families up until then were actually from North Africa. So like, we're not talking about the authenticity of Georgia. We're talking about the authenticity of the Shuk and how it developed and how the Israeli society has developed. And also another thing is that, like, you know, a lot of the times, it's a little bit of a struggle. Like, you know, you're having like this bite and it's incredible. And like, you know, you want to get some to your home, but you simply can't because it won't be fresh. Right. It won't have the same flavor. It won't have the same texture. So it's this kind of an experience that you can only have at this specific setting of this time and this place.
Okay. Nice. Okay. So I'm going to again cycle back a little here, because I think you raised some important points about the borders. And I'd like to hear a little bit about how you approach and guide, as someone who's, you know, focused on Jerusalem, how do you approach and guide the Arab-Israeli conflict? You know, what role does that play in your guiding? Do you talk about it? And if you do, how?
So first of all, I think that like it's something that you cannot ignore. Even if someone is coming just like, you know, for a Shuk tour for 2.5 hours, the fact that you hardly hear any Arabic and you're in Jerusalem, it's not something that you can ignore. So we're definitely present at, you know, pretty much at every interaction I have when I'm leading a tour. And the second
one
thing
second, is, I would say that some people might even criticize that and say, you know, well, you know, Israelis are trying to take attention away from the conflict by doing Shuk tours, right? So just, you know, as a critique that I could imagine, you know, some people who aren't fans of Israel might put out there. Let's put that out there as well.
Absolutely. No. Like here, it's definitely a thing, like, you know, to mention and to put up. And honestly, I'll say that it's very much like modified by the client. You know, like I have clients who are extremely interested about it. I have clients that like don't even aware to the situation. And honestly, like there are so many borders, that you can talk about in Jerusalem. So of course, like, you know, we have the Israeli-Arabic conflict, but we also have a gender issue, which is very much present in the city because we're talking about communities that are either modern or traditional, whether it's like, you know, the Israeli or the Arab. We have a social economical border that is very much present wherever you're walking around Jerusalem. Jerusalem is actually considered to be the poorest city in Israel. So there are so many conflicts that, that we're facing when we're walking around Jerusalem. So honestly, it's very much focused on the client and where they're coming from and what are their fields of interest.
Okay. And in terms of an educational approach to explaining the conflict, is there some particular way, is there a way you prefer to talk about the conflict with your guests?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm not sure that I'm being clear. I think, you know, of course, every person is different, but is your approach more to try to talk about the social issues or the historical? Do you provide, you know, a background? Do you talk about, you know, your own family's stories regarding the conflict? Because, I mean, I'm sure there are people in your, you know, your parents' generation, your family members who experienced the divided Jerusalem. So, like, how do you talk about that? You know, what do you do when people come and, you know, ask, are we in occupied territory now? Are we, where are we? Are we in occupied territory? Is this East Jerusalem? You know, do you discuss those aspects? How do you explain the wall? These are all different things that I think are, you know, you have an interesting perspective because of your family history.
So first of all, I share a lot of my family history on my tours. I hope it's not too much, but I do. And so I try to combine like those stories with like what we experience on the tour itself and also using Google Maps. You know, like opening Google Map when you're trying to say like, oh, where we are regarding this line, where we are regarding that line. Let's walk a few steps to the left. Where are we now? Does it feel any different? Should it feel any different? What makes it feel different?
So you do that with them. That's interesting. I've never tried that. How do people take that when you do that?
It's very interesting because I feel that it connects them to their world because, like, you know, modern people use Google Maps 24/7. And when I have educational groups, I also tell them to Google the map of Israel in different languages. So like in Hebrew or in English, maybe the map of Palestine. And just like, you know, sometimes by the discussion of like, how do we draw the map and then where we are regarding the drawing right now, that's the entire conversation.
Do you ever have, on your tours, do you ever have a chance to meet local people, either Arabs or Jews, religious or non-religious? Do you do tours where you actually are meeting people and they're telling a little bit about themselves? Or is it, you know, you're the one who's guiding and you introduce very briefly. Is there a chance for people to actually meet Jerusalemites in your tours?
Definitely. I think that like if someone has visited Jerusalem more than twice, they know that like the most classic Jerusalem thing to do is to run into someone that you know on the street without planning. And I think that this is part of like the authentic experience, to talk to someone, but when it's unplanned, like I don't really like, you know, booking with people. Yeah. Like, you know, we'll go to your place. You'll show them the rooftop. You'll talk about the view, what it feels. I feel that this is kind of like a weird setup. And I much rather
Because it's kind of constructed? Why is it a weird setup?
Exactly. It's not authentic. It's planned in advance. I much more rather, you know, like stopping for, you know, for telling them, you know, like, I know we've been walking around for 3 hours. There's this incredible patisserie that just opened up. It belongs to a Christian Arab guy. Let's go. Like, you know, we have the best ginger cookies. And he'll share a little bit of his story. Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I feel like those kind of meetings are much more real. And I also feel that it's like, you know, it feels in terms of like the person who's traveling, that it's much more honest. You can ask anything. You can talk about anything because originally the conversation is not supposed to be leading to one specific point.
Yeah, and I struggle with that a lot because I really, one of the things that I really want to do is more P2P type of tours, you know, people to people type of tours. But the people who are offering these kind of home experiences, that's really their full-time job, right? So they're presenting a certain kind of, I know, for example, there are Palestinians who they make a lot of money by having groups come to their house and talking about what it's like to be a Palestinian under occupation. There are religious Jews that do the same thing where they talk about what it's like to be religious. And on the one hand, I want my guests to meet these people. But on the other hand, I also feel like there's something, you know, artificial about it.
Very much. And you know, like, I mean, using, you know, who I am, what I'm doing, I know that, let's say I'm going to a shuk tour and I always leave 30 minutes to the end to the coffee place. Because I know most of the people who drink their coffee on the regular basis. And if I have good dynamic with the groups, I'll introduce them. And they'll have a chance to chat and hang out. And like, I'm not there. Like, you know, I'm taking the order. I'm making sure everyone will receive their drinks. And I think that this is a real meeting. And this will be much more meaningful than, you know, like going to someone's house and hear the lecture and see the pictures on the wall. Because this is like, it's authentic. That's the only word.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Absolutely. And that's what people remember, by the way. I mean, those kind of experiences from my experience, they don't remember if some, you know, if they see a building and it's like, is this Byzantine or is it, you know, Roman? They don't remember that stuff. They remember these human interactions. And that's the kind of, that's more authentic. And that's the direction that I personally am kind of struggling with. How can I get it so that I can do more of that? Because that's what I want.
Oh, it's easy. Experience. Just like, you know, live in the same place, go to the same coffee place for 3 years and you're good.
Well, I think you raise a really important point. I mean, as someone, again, you know, I throw it out there as an anthropologist, you know, anthropology is a very slow discipline and we're supposed to live in a place for at least a year before we can even have any ideas about a place. And so that is, you know, that is something to be said for the type of tourism that you're offering because you're really of the place. So while at first maybe you went all over the country, now this kind of decision of yours to be in this place, I think is wonderful because you're offering something that, you know, someone like myself who lives in Haifa can't because I don't live there. I can't experience it.
And this is why I'm struggling so much with leading tours outside of Jerusalem because I know like what are the different things I can do in Jerusalem. Like, you know, in terms of like my knowledge, I can lead like, you know, 2 days tour in Tel Aviv, but it won't be as deep and it won't be as like, you know, interactive and as meaningful as 3 hours in Jerusalem.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to circle back because I don't feel like we gave it, you know, the question justice by our little kind of little talk, but I want to hear a little bit about how you think, you know, being a woman as a guide affects your guiding in a sense and also your guiding experience. And what are the, you know, constraints and, you know, advantages and disadvantages, whatever you want to talk about, in fact, about this topic.
So, I mean, first of all, I mean, I haven't been like, you know, in the men position, so I can't really compare.
Fair enough.
Just fair enough. From my perspective. Sure. But, you know, first of all, I mean, many of my colleagues are men and not women. I feel that tour guide is a very male environment because again,
I agree with you. I just want to say, I agree with you completely. But when I've said this to other women guides, they get kind of offended that I might say but it feels a little bit like a male environment.
I feel that it's very like male oriented because first of all, like, you know, just the fact that, I mean, being out of home for longer hours, sometimes even overnight is much more acceptable for men than for a woman. More than that, just like, you know, to be able to stand in front of a group, you know, like we live, like, you know, again, 21st century, modern world, da 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 da.
Right.
Traditionally, women are supposed to be quiet. They shouldn't stand out. If a woman is too loud and she's taking too much attention, who knows how she's using it? What does it tell about her and about her integrity? And I mean, it's something that I'm struggling with myself. The fact that, you know, again, I was raised in a very open-minded environment, like, you know, to be at the top of your class, be the best that you can. But still, like, you know, getting all this attention, sometimes I need to remind myself, okay, like, you know, relax. don't let it go up to your head. And by the way, I feel like a lot of the tour guides, like, we are, it's like a lot of people hate to be around us because of it. You know, like we're used to having like all those goggly eyes, like listening to us, like following us. Like if someone just like, you know, allowing themselves to go deep into that, this can be horrible.
You know, there's the old joke. I may have already said it on this podcast. There's this old joke, which is the tour guide arrives at the hotel on the first day and he walks up to his guests and he says, "Hi, I'm your guide." And the next day he comes in the morning and he says, "Hi, I'm your guide." By the third day he comes by and he says, "Hi, I'm your God."
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It gets to your head, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, men, like it's perfectly fine for them, like, you know, to be at the top of the line and have everyone lead them. But for women, again, like very modern world, very modern family, but still, like it's not their natural spot to be at.
I want to add one more thing and, you know, correct me if you think this is wrong, but I think part of it also is for me, guiding on some level, every time you have like these tours, especially the longer ones, but even like, you know, these one days, sometimes they're like military campaigns. You got to like wake up at 4 a.m. and you got to drive, you know, and meet other people and like, you know, coordinate. And there's the logistics and all this kind of stuff that goes on. And it feels like this kind of military, you know, everything has to work and be precise for it to succeed. And it's almost like a military, you know, campaign of some sort. And so in that sense, it also feels masculine to me, even though.
But it's funny because for me, that's how I started to give tours in the army. So like for me, I mean, like, you know, again, today, and like touring is for pleasure, but beginning, I was shocked. Like, you know, the traveler's day starts after breakfast at 9. I'm like, no, like you should start at 7. What's wrong with you? But also I feel that, I mean, also I'm relatively young in that field. I mean, I'm 30. I started giving tours when I was 18 in the army, 19 after this gap year. So basically I have to prove myself every time, if it's to the clients or to the bus drivers, all those small things.
Oh yeah. There's a whole discussion, right?
Exactly.
The bus drivers.
Exactly. And I always have to pick my fights. You know, like, am I flexible about times, or am I flexible about the location, or am I flexible about, like, you know, how much, let's say, you know, if it's an organized trip, like how much do I change and adapt the schedule by what the clients want in the field versus what the organizers want back in the office? Yeah.
And sometimes it's not even the organizers in the office, because they're actually providing the tour for an organizer in another country. Like I worked with an organizer that was basically the destination management consultant for a company which sits in Switzerland, and the company in Switzerland wanted certain things, and so it had to be a certain way, you know. So
exactly. And I mean, like, don't get me wrong, I'm sure that every tour guide, and I'm like, I'm sure that every tour guide still with it, like, you know, regardless their gender, but I feel like doing it as a female is a completely different situation.
Well, you mentioned
we're being looked at different. Yeah,
the bus drivers oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes the bus drivers in Israel are coming from the Arab sector, either in Jerusalem or in the Galilee. They're coming from the Arab sector. It's not a very well-paying job being a bus driver. And so the lower socioeconomic classes are the ones who are driving. And as a result, often you'll get quite traditional people, right? And then you get on the bus, and you are responsible for the entire tour. And that means that you're the one calling the shots about where you're going and when you're going and what you're doing. And it's not always easy to, you know, even for me as a man, I sometimes have to struggle with the drivers, because they may have been driving buses for 20 years and I'm only been a guide for 4 years. And they're used to a certain way of doing it, and I want to do something different. And there's always pushback. But as a woman, there's this added layer of, you know, especially a young woman, there's this added layer of like, you know, who are you, you know, lady? You know, tell us a little bit about that if you've experienced it.
Of course. So first of all, I'm always like, when I'm in this situation, I try to fall into the position of like, tell me about your kids. Like, do you have any daughters? How old are they? And that creates a whole different dynamic. When I actually like make them feel like they need to take care of me rather than I need to run the schedule for them. They're like, oh, like, you know, it'll be really helpful if you'll do that. It will help me a lot if you'll do this. But then another time,
and that's good because they actually have a lot of knowledge, you know, and they, and
exactly. And that's the other thing. Yeah. Exactly. Like, I'm always like, you know, when it gets to drivers, especially it's something that I learned in the army. I'm extremely respectful because at the end of the day, in terms of the road, they know the best. And even like, you know, even in the military, frame, sometimes like, you know, they knew things before I did. So I always make sure like, you know, to listen to what they have to say, and to respect them, also their knowledge, but also the basic things. Like, you know, if we go to lunch, like, okay, listen, like, this is your lunch money. Do you want me to give it to you? Shall I buy something for you? Like, you know, because we're going to the shuk. Shall I use this money and like buy you something and give it to you later? What do you prefer? And at the end of the day, I think like being a tour guide is all about the dynamic. You and the driver, you and your group, you and the person at the hotel, like, you know, whether they will help you out or not. And regardless, all our knowledge, this is the basic thing.
Now, you mentioned that you just got engaged and, you know, you're going to get married soon, and God willing, there'll be some kids along the way. Well, how do you feel about, you know, as a woman, you know, with kids, how does that affect your experience as a guide? You don't have kids yet, but what you've seen.
Exactly. So I don't know yet.
What do you plan to do? How do you want to approach it?
I mean, the way that I do it now, every time that I'm leading a group, they are my top priority. Like, I won't answer my phone, none of that. But I'm sure that, like, you know, once I'll become a mother, this will have to change because there will be something that is more important, than my job. But this is also one of the reasons that I chose to be focused on a geographical area that I can actually work and live in, for example, you know, versus, you know, living outside of the city, which will be much, you know, cheaper, and like, you know, the community might be stronger and it might be easier to raise the children. But then it means that I have to be driving to work every day for an hour and a half each direction.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard some people actually say that guiding is a good profession for women in the sense that if you live in Jerusalem, you can actually, you know, be home every day by 6 o'clock or something like that.
Either that or, you know, like spend the day at home with the children. And then, like, you know, when my fiance comes back from work, I can lead a night tour, a nightlife experience. Right. So in that term, this should be very flexible.
The other thing is that it is a flexible profession because you decide when you want to work, actually, right? You're not actually working in a, you know, for a company. You're taking gigs. This is kind of a gig economy. Classic gig economy type job. And there are days when I don't want to work, like, you know, I need to do something with my kids, and so I just say that I'm busy that day. Like, I don't have to explain anything. I just say I'm just not available. So in that way, I think being a guide is actually good, not only for women but for men as well. You know, if you don't want to work, you don't have to be in the office from 9 to 5 like in other professions.
But on the other end, it's also a very unstable. It's something that we experience right now. You know, last year my calendar was fully booked, and right now it's fully empty.
Right. And I want to ask about that in a little bit. But before we go there, I wanted to also touch on how we met, and I wanted to hear about your experience. So we actually met as, you know, studying together for a birthright training, to be birthright educators, as they call it. And I've talked to other people. There have been other people on the show who were also in that training with us. The latest one that's come out, also Daniel, we studied all of us together with him as well. Since then, I've actually done a bunch of birthrights. I've done 16 birthrights since the course that we were on, right? So
it's a lot.
it feels like a lot, right? Because each one is 10 days. Right. And again, for our listeners, Birthright is this free trip that's provided by the Jewish community, the State of Israel, and private donors for people who have Jewish heritage to come and spend 10 days here. So I've literally spent like 160 days doing tours for Birthright. What was your Birthright experience like? And now, you know, you're talking about being local. That's the opposite. Birthright is, you know, the opposite of that because you're everywhere in 10 days. So what was your experience like? And are you still guiding for Birthright?
So I was guiding, I don't remember if it was like 8 or 9 trips.
Okay. That's also.
And eventually I stopped. I felt that there was a huge gap between the planning, like, you know, like the thought of like the end, like what it should be, which is incredible. But there was a huge gap between that versus what's happening in reality, and the needs and like, you know, the different wills of the people who are coming on this trip. And like, you know, we talked before, but this balance, right? Between like what the organizers and the planners and those who give the money and those who are actually here. And I feel like the gap is too big. You know, like you're not traveling 12. Sure. Like, you know, you're not traveling 12 hours on a plane, to spend, let's say 5 hours a day on average on the bus for 10 days. You know, like if you are like, you know, for the first time you are out of America, you don't want to be on schedule all the time. You know, we want to have
a little bit overprogrammed.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, if, and I also think that like, you know, if we want, you know, a traveling experience to be meaningful, you have to give more time to process, to debrief officially and also unofficially. We need to have much more, you know, downtimes. But they're not actually down because like, you know, you're doing all kind of different processing on the go. Again, I think like, you know, education through traveling is, I think, one of the most powerful tools that we have. This is also one of the reasons that I'm a tour guide. You know, I want to make an impact on the world. And I feel like, you know, leading someone through this complicated city, is an incredible way of doing that. But I feel like it's just, on one hand, it's too much birthright. And on the other hand, it's not enough.
Right.
It's like they aim very high and they can't reach it at the, like the way that they're doing it right now.
And how did you feel working for Birthright as a tour guide? Like, I know I've heard from other guides, you know, that have decided to take a step back and are not working with Birthright now. For them, a lot of it was just simply that Birthright is asking too much of guides in terms of, you know, the number of hours that we work and what they're trying to accomplish, you know, because they're doing
again,
so
I mean,
much.
Because I started doing it as a soldier, it's something that's probably going to stick for me forever. Like starting the schedule, like leaving the hotel at 7 and ending the day at like 2 a.m. sounds okay to me. Like that's how I did it for 2 years.
I see.
That was my first guiding experience. And I mean, as long as everyone are on board, like that this is how it's going to go, I think it's phenomenal. It's just not the situation.
So your issue is more programmatic rather than in, you know, in terms of the way you know, the employment aspects of it. It was more about the programming or the lack or the over-programming and the lack of certain types of programming.
Exactly.
And so in the future, do you plan to do another Birthright or you're on holiday?
You know,
now,
like, never say never. Right.
Right.
But I really think that the thing I do the best is the Jerusalem-based tours. So, so I hope just to keep and do that. And not like, you know, lead a tour, a long one.
So I want to hear a little bit about how this past year has affected you and also how it's affected Jerusalem. I know I've only been to Jerusalem in a typical, you know, work week, or work month. I'm in Jerusalem. I live in Haifa, which is, you know, more than 2 hours away by car. And typically I would be in Jerusalem at least 2 or 3 times a week, right? Now I've been in Jerusalem in the last year. I've probably been in Jerusalem maybe 10 times. And every time that I've gone, it's been really sad, right? It's been really impacted, especially the old city. What you see there is all the shuttered shops and everything. How did Corona find you and what's been going on there? And what's happening to these, you know, these poor people in you know, who are so dependent on tourism?
So I actually have to start from the end because like you said that, you know, you came to the old city and it's very sad and all the shuttered are closed and you are walking, I assume, through the path that you're walking, with your groups. So right. Like you're going to the old city from the touristic, perspective, but when you're actually exploring the local perspective, it's thriving. For example, if you're going to the area of the Damascus Gate, which is the local Arabic speaking market. For the people of, like, you know, the Palestinians live in Jerusalem. It's incredible because all of a sudden they have the stores, like, you know, the really good stores for themselves. They don't have to compete in it, with the tourists that somehow get to this area and everything is much more fresh. Even like, you know, the small kebab place, which I love, They are thriving because from before they were just for the local people, like, you know, the tour guides and like, you know, with the larger groups that came were kind of in their way. And now all of, so like, you know, the, everything that have to do like locally scale is thriving. If it's in terms of communities that have gone much stronger or even developed during the last year, all the local businesses that now has been moved, you know, everything that can be, like shopped by delivery is thriving. Tourism, of course, is not. Of course, by the law in Israel right now, anyone that doesn't carry an Israeli ID cannot enter Israel, if not for a, you know, unique reason. If it's like, you know, for a business, for, or for a special marriage, you can get approval. So of course we don't have any of those tourists. And during the first lockdown, I was very strict. Like I literally did not go out of my home for almost 3 months. It was pretty horrible. But after that, I started walking around and honestly, I feel like all the infrastructure was, almost losing it because it was almost like over tourism. We had so many people coming. The buses couldn't handle it. The roads couldn't handle it. The places were packed with people. And honestly, like walking right now around, like, you know, the holy sites is an incredible experience. You get to see the place. No one is pushing you. No one is chasing you. Right. And it's a whole different situation. There was actually a point where I thought to myself, like, you know, maybe this is the time to go to Venice, because if this, this is what Jerusalem looks like, maybe Venice is exactly the same.
Yeah. Paris, Venice, all these places of over tourism.
Exactly. Exactly. And honestly, I'm very fortunate. First of all, because my fiancé is what we call oved chiyuni. So that would be like an essential worker.
Essential
so like
worker,
he keeps working.
Yeah.
Exactly. So like he keeps working regardless lockdowns. So we still have some income. And another thing is that I work, even from before the pandemic, I work with non-Israelis and with Israelis as well. And after the end of the first lockdown, Israelis, like, you know, kept back to touring and traveling within Israel because this is what we can do. So when we're not during lockdown, which is not like right now, I lead tours for Israelis, which is incredible. It's kind of like, you know, rediscovering, where you are. And there's actually a project that I started working on almost 2 years ago now, through Yalabasta, which is one of the agencies I work with. It's called Amazon Explore. And at the beginning, so like up until a month and a half ago, it was top secret. I wasn't allowed to talk to anyone about it. And the concept at the time was very weird. The concept is like, you know, some client is sitting in North America or wherever they are in the globe watching television and I appear on their television live. And I am walking around a location in Jerusalem and I give a virtual tour and they can ask me, oh, like, what is this on the right side? What is this behind you? What is this on the left? I want you to explain me what this is. And because it's being like provided by Amazon.
You wear like a GoPro or something? How do you do it?
So I have a gimbal. I have a gimbal, which is, it's kind of a stabilizer. And I have a special phone that connected to it and headsets. So it's like very light. I like walk around and I can play around with the camera if it's towards me or towards what I see.
Nice.
And because it's provided by Amazon, there's also a shopping experience. So they can also like, you know, see things and buy them and they'll be shipped to their doorstep within less than 3 weeks. And 2 years ago, people were like, this is nonsense. Like, just keep working as a tour guide. And I felt that I had to give it a shot. You know, I know that I'm young, but like, you know, doing the same thing for 11 years, it's quite, you know, a nice chunk amount of time. And I didn't realize how incredible it's going to be that, you know, I'm working now with clients for non-Israelis. And this is extremely unique in this situation.
So you've started providing these tours?
Yeah. I mean, you can, right now, the clients can only be from the United States. We wanted to do this experience actually in Taiwan for my father's birthday. But right now it's open just from clients with an American, IP. Yeah.
Right.
And it's so cool. I don't have any other word.
Are you the only one doing this or are there other people in Jerusalem?
Right now there are three of us. Right now there are three of us in Jerusalem. I know that there are a few others in Israel that are not leading tours for the Amazon Explore, but do kind of like different things. But yeah, this is kind of like just us doing it. And, you know, I was thinking about this. I was thinking like the clients, you know, because I talked to them like, yeah, how are you? Where are you from? Mm-hmm. What time is it over there? And I think for the clients, it's a way to like disconnect from this weird, weird reality we live in right mm-hmm. now. And even before the pandemic, I think that like, you know, traveling to a different place is a way to kind of like, you know, clear your head, get a different perspective.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's something that we can't do right now. But, you know, it's very interesting. Right before this lockdown started, it was the time of Christmas. And Israelis mm-hmm. right now, obviously, they can't travel abroad, right? They can't go and experience mm-hmm. the Christmas time. So a lot of them came and hired me to be their Christmas tour guide here in Jerusalem. And in 3 days, I had 6 groups, and 4 out of them, when they met me, they were like, hi, would you mind if we'll smoke? And I'm like, sure, we're outdoors. And like, no, would you mind if we'll smoke weed or pot or whatever? And it was just like an extreme situation where I saw how people need traveling to take a step back from their lives, to be in a different place, to celebrate mm-hmm. a different holiday, to see like, you know, mm-hmm. different culture. And of course, like, you know, this is an extreme situation where people are like, you know, high, walking around, like, you know, in the old city, celebrating a holiday that is like, you know, far from them. And like, you know, we talked before with this like essential need, and people think that traveling is kind of luxury. Mm-hmm. But I think
that luxury good is what we always say. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think that it's an actual need sometimes to take a deep breath, to go to a different place, see things from a different perspective, whether if it's physically or even online through this like weird Amazon experience.
So this Amazon experience, if somebody listening to this in the United States, of course, with a US IP, wanted to hire you to do this tour, how would they do it? Is there you have a web address? I mean, I can put it into the program notes of this episode if you would like. But is there a way for them to do this?
So it's actually quite easy. You just go into the website called Amazon Explore. And there you have, you need to choose the right continent, which is Europe.
We're in Europe?
For some reason, our place. Apparently, we're in Europe.
That's strange. I never knew that. I thought I was in Asia.
Speaking of borders, this is a very interesting, you know, placement where we were put. And then you have the Machane Yehuda Market Action Packed experience.
Awesome. And so there they can choose you. Is there like a little like picture of you or?
No, unfortunately, you can't choose who your guide will be. There are 3 of us.
Okay.
And honestly, because the shuk right now, because of the lockdown, after the sun goes down, there is nothing really much happening around. So during specifically the lockdown, we don't offer this experience.
The next couple of weeks.
Exactly.
Yeah. By the time, knock on wood, by the time this podcast comes out, which will probably be at least another 3-4 weeks, then hopefully by then they'll be able to go in and take this tour.
I hope so very much.
I just want to end with a couple questions that I've also started asking people. I just kind of want to hear from you. What do you think makes somebody a good tour guide?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think you have to be flexible and to adapt yourself all the time. If it's like to where you are, and especially to your clients, and especially being a good mediator between the environment and the client, and the client and the environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another question that I've been asking, well, I've always asked people what their favorite place to guide in Israel, but I think I know what it is for you. So I'm not going to ask you that question. There are some other ones, though, that I can ask. And one of them is, have you ever guided any famous people? Anybody who's like a celebrity or anything like that? And what was that experience like?
So, you know, it's funny. I led a group a few years ago, and one, like someone on the group was just like, I saw him participating on a Netflix show.
Oh, really?
2 days ago. Yeah. He's a chef. His name is Yaniv. I don't remember his last name, but he's an incredible chef. He has a restaurant in California called Jaffa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one that I can recall that is like a proper celebrity.
Okay. All right. Have you ever had a crisis experience of any sort while guiding?
And we're going there.
I want to know. I'm just interested. Is there ever? Tell us a good story. Guides tell best.
Wow. Yeah, we have incredible stories.
We have great stories, I think.
So I think like the most basic one for me would be like leading a tour in Jerusalem at the time there is a terrorist attack happening. Unfortunately, like for me, that would be a regular thing, especially like growing up in Jerusalem during the time of the Intifada. Mm-hmm. So like during the time of the terrorist attacks between 2000 to 2002.
This is what we call the second Intifada.
Exactly. So like a lot of people will say that this is a crisis, but for me, it was just another day at the job. Unfortunately, you know, so when I just received my license, mm-hmm. Somehow a friend recommended me, long story short, there was a NASA convention here in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I was sure that I was giving a tour to engineers from Texas. And mm-hmm. at the end of the tour, they're like, yeah, you know, like we're space engineers from Houston, Texas, and we work for NASA. And for the next, like, you know, they were here.
Those are kind of celebrities.
Exactly, kind of, yeah. And for a week, I was leading what I call the astronauts' wives. Because like all the men were in the convention and like their uh-huh. wives wanted like, you know, different tours. And we went to Enkarem, which is a small area right at the very end of Jerusalem that is affiliated with John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And those like four women are very religious. And mm-hmm. like, you know, we walk the second before we step into the church, one of them receiving a phone call. And she's like starting like, you know, to freak out. And apparently it was her son that is using again after he went to rehab because he wasn't hired for a job that he applied. Mm-hmm. And he took the family car. And he did a massive accident.
Wow.
And his car is total lost and there are other people trapped in the car. And he kept calling and telling her the story because it was so high. He didn't remember. He just told her the story. And, wow. you know, like I told her, like, listen, we can take a break. We can like, you know, go find a lawyer or whatever. She's like, no, I want to go to the church. Okay. So we go into the church and like, you know, she and her friends, like they're praying like really hard and they light the candles. And when she go out of the church, she received another phone call. And she's mm-hmm. like, thank you, thank you, thank you. What's your name? And apparently it was a policeman telling her that no one was hurt and that it was just the car that is total lost and that the sponsor will come and take the son and like no charges will be taken. Everything's okay. Wow. And she told him just, what's your name, sir? And he told her, Officer Cohen.
Oh, really?
And she looks at me. Yeah. And she looks at me. He's like, you know, it's the church.
It's a miracle. Like, yes, ma'am. It's really a miracle.
The church.
Wow.
Yeah. So that would be one.
That's a great story.
I had this experience where I was leading a group of over 40 people and our passports were all gone. And within 3 days, we had to recreate.
This.
Yeah.
I remember this, the crazy story.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like a very short version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was...
Well, they managed to do it. Everybody got their passports in the end.
Exactly. It was just, I mean, the process was traumatic, right. But the outcome was
very,
okay.
Yeah, it must have been very traumatic at the time for you, you know, even though it wasn't your
fault.
And the travelers. It wasn't your fault in any way. You weren't the one with the passports.
Yeah.
But
you know, at the end of the day, exactly. At the end of the day, like, you know, pointing fingers is not going to solve the problem.
Right.
You know, like the fact that we were in this situation is horrible on its own.
Right. Right. No, you did great though. Everyone got their passport. Everyone went back home when they were planning to go back. I remember this story. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely falls under the crisis situation.
Yeah.
Okay. I have just like two more questions. One is I didn't ask you, I know that you also give art tours, right? Mm-hmm. Or because you said you studied art history. What does that look like? What kind of what does it mean if someone wants to book you for an art tour? What do you do with your guest?
This is a huge question because the way that I see it, art is a language. And like when you speak it, it's not the question is like what are you going like? No, it's not a question of language. It's the question of topic. You know, like we can do an art tour based on this concept of old city and modern city. We can do an art tour based on modern artists in Jerusalem today and like what is the current art language that we use in the city today. We can do an art tour based on like museums and at the same time as a street art tour.
Mm, right.
So we have all those, like, you know, we can also take it to the religion aspect, you know, to have an entire day just about Jewish art and then Muslim art and then Christian art.
Right.
And then see where we have the dialogue there.
Awesome. So if somebody wants to get in touch with you in general, what's the best way for them to do so?
So the best way to do so is to know someone that came on a tour with me, because this is how it works. So right now, my father really wants me to open a website, which I understand. It's like an important thing. But I really believe that, like, if someone had a good experience with me, they will pass my information onward. And it means that if someone get my information that way, that they will also have a good experience with me. Because
if somebody wants to send you an email right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there an email address that you can share with us?
Yeah. And the email address, honestly, the best thing to do will be to send me a WhatsApp message. Okay. I'm more available there.
I don't know if you want to give your WhatsApp number though.
Of course, you're right. So we'll do email. Yeah, so let's do the email. So it's ORIUNTERMAN. So ORIUNTERMAN in one word. @gmail.com.
Okay. And I'm going to include this also in the program notes so that people can get in touch with you. This was amazing. I want to thank you so much for agreeing to have this conversation. I really enjoyed and learned a lot. And I hope you had a good time as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Eyal. You know, I was afraid that I'll keep using the word I, and it will be kind of like, you know, an ego boost. But I hope it wasn't, because I had a great time.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time, and I look forward to when, you know, we can, you know, meet again in the Shuk and hang out and, you know, really spend some time together once these lockdowns are finished and, you know, this whole Corona situation is behind us.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, how did you enjoy this episode? I have always found Ori to be so well-spoken, passionate, and clear. Most of all, I especially admire her appreciation for being a seventh-generation Jerusalemite and her deep sense of rootedness in Jerusalem. I am reminded of the quote by the great African-American novelist James Baldwin, who wrote, "Know from whence you came. If you know whence you came, there are absolutely no limitations to where you can go." I have no doubt that this is true in the case of Ori. I would add also that it's interesting to note that this concept is actually built into the Hebrew language. The word for forward, kadima, is actually from the same root as the word for past, kedem. After our interview, I remembered that I forgot to ask her about her participation in poetry slams. So, if you are Hebrew speaking, I encourage you to look this up on YouTube under her name, Ori Unterman. This is yet another example of how articulate and brilliant she is. Also, please make sure to check out her Facebook and sign up for the latest project of online tours of the Machane Yehuda Market. You can find all of this information in the program notes for this episode and on the website. For next time, we also have a great episode lined up with tour guide Elinora Nitzani. Elinora will share her experience of living all over the world and how this background has shaped her outlook and experiences as a guide. Trained in agricultural studies and an expert in plants, Elinora also takes visitors on tours that explore Israel's latest advances in agritech. Tune in next time to hear more about these interesting topics. Okay, I think I've talked enough in the intro, so I'm just going to call it quits for today. I just add lastly that if you could please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, or subscribe through the website at tourguideconfidential.com. All right, see you next time, and remember, tour guides tell the best stories.